really excited to be here. It's fantastic. I think it's the first time that so many people from around the country have got together to talk about the climate movement and how we're going to work together. And I think it's a really important moment. So I'm going to talk briefly about where we've come to, what I think some of the key lessons are from the climate movement thus far, and outline a couple of thoughts about where I think the movement needs to go over the next year, and to address a couple of what I think are the key strategic questions for the movement. This is an important moment in history. The start of the 2009 Parliament marks the failure of the Australian political system to deal with climate change. A government elected with a mandate to take action on climate change has comprehensively failed to take meaningful action. Both major parties are completely out to lunch. We need action from the corporate sector. We need bureaucrats lobbying for incremental gains. We need people within the major parties. We need more scientific research. But beyond all of that, we need a social movement that is going to make climate change action necessary, so that it's not just impossible for Kevin Rudd to stand up and give us a 5% target. We need to make it impossible for him to do anything but deliver the action that is required for an emergency response to climate change. And we need a movement that's going to make it impossible for any business leader to stand up in public and try and delay action. It's up to us. Take a look at the people around in this room. These are the people. Have a look. People in this room are the people who are taking leadership on climate change in this country. The person sitting next to you, it's all of us who over the next couple of days are going to work together to come up with plans and strategies for what may well be the most important struggle in human history. Now, when I was a kid, I always used to, you know, had great visions of grandeur, you know, when you're kind of 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever, and I wanted to live in a period of history that was, you know, exciting, where you had some great moral struggle. But, geez, I didn't want this. I don't think any of us wanted this. I wanted to be an architect or a blacksmith or something like that. And then through a process of elimination, you end up being a climate activist because it is the only thing that makes sense. There's been a lot of talk about the failure of the climate movement, a lot of soul searching, a lot of despair, as well as a lot of hope. Looking back at 2008, did the movement fail? On the face of it, sure, we failed. The Rudd government caved into the big polluters. We've got an emissions trading scheme, which isn't going to cut emissions. Its fundamental design purpose is to lock in property rights for polluters so that in future they'll be compensated for any reductions. It is exactly the opposite of what is required. The White Paper is a profound failure, but is it a failure of the movement? Now, I've been getting the sense that we somehow failed to protect something that we'd won previously. Now, I don't really agree. I mean, when we say that Rudd has broken his promise, it's politics. Sure, Rudd has broken his promise to take action on climate change, but I don't believe that when the election happened, I don't believe Rudd promised anything more than 5 to 15% cuts. And I think that if we thought that, we're probably guilty of optimism would be my sort of generous term for it. Look, after 10 years of Howard, it was always going to be difficult to dampen optimism for the new government. There was always going to be a risk that the movement would lose momentum while we give him a chance to fail. And if this summit had happened in November last year, or if this summit had happened any time last year, we'd be having this conversation about, well, we just need to give Rudd some more space to do the right thing. And it's why it's important this summit is happening now, because Rudd was going to fail. He has failed now, and it's clear. The politics are much clearer. The Labor government is just as beholden to the vested interests of the big polluters as a coalition government ever will be. So after the last election, we didn't sustain pressure on MPs, even though we needed to, even though we knew we needed to. We didn't build our power after the election, we let it wane. We didn't try and diminish the power of the vested interests and the fossil fuel interests, we let it flourish. When the Business Council came out in August and started calling for stabilisation, the day after that, we should have had 50 people in their office serving them an eviction notice for antisocial behaviour, and we should have sent their executives off to Christmas Island or Nauru or something, or sandbagging in Kiribati, because that's That's the kind of, I mean, it's the kind of backlash that I think we need to be creating for the corporate sector. When BHP comes out lobbying against action on climate change, we should have been there saying this is completely unacceptable for these people to be threatening our future in this way. But instead, we rolled with the punches, waiting for Kevin Rudd to save us. Basic political economy tells us that climate change is a struggle over vested interests. The government will do what is required on climate change when they have to, when the cost of inaction outweigh the cost of action. Now, at the moment, the vested interests in the coal, oil, gas, cement, aluminium industries are far more powerful than we are. Our challenge is to build our power while diminishing theirs. In terms of this power equation, 2008 was interesting because it was the first time the big polluters were forced to show their power that we always knew they had. Previously, their influence had been very much covert. This last year, they were forced to come out publicly, and they came out hard and they fought hard, and we got a sense of how much power they really have over the political process. And from our side, with a few notable exceptions, we didn't really build our power and we didn't show the power that we had until after the white paper decision was made. So what did we do well in 2008? A couple of moments stand out clearly in my mind. There was this fantastic lobbying meeting where this person from one of the big NGOs was in this meeting, and they had this really great discussion paper that argued that 25% cuts by 2020 on 1990 levels was really possible and within reach, and there was this economic model that backed it up, and they said to this minister, "We need cuts," and the minister said, "I don't give a shit." And so the person went to climate camp instead, which was one of the most inspiring events that I have ever been to. So over 1,000 people took part in peaceful civil disobedience to stop coal exports at the world's biggest coal port in Newcastle. We stopped coal trains going through for an entire day. Over 60 people were arrested for trespass. Hundreds of people had one of the most empowering and inspiring days of their lives. When I got back to camp that night, there were people with these huge grins on their face, and there was just this incredible energy of people just feeling that they had done something that they believed in. They'd stood up for what they knew was right, they'd taken action that they knew was required, and by the end of the day, I don't know how many tons of CO2 we delayed, but it was a lot, and we had national media attention saying that told the story to the rest of Australia that climate change is so important, it is so urgent, that we cannot sit back and watch it. We need to take action. So for me, the really exciting thing about climate change wasn't actually that day with 1,000 people taking action. It was the next day when a couple of young students from Brisbane decided at 11 o'clock that they were going to do it all again. The four of them were going to go and blockade the world's biggest coal port by themselves. They had a meeting at 11 o'clock. At 1 o'clock, they jumped over the fence, flagged down a coal train, tied themselves to the track and shut down the port for 3 hours. Now, that's happening all over the country every week. That's when we'll start to get change on climate change. Yeah. The second thing that I think we did really well this year was the backlash against the white paper. I was really surprised by it. I think everyone was really surprised by it. The shoe throwing of Kevin Rudd, who thought of that? But, you know, it was a really important moment to set us up for this year, and I think we nailed it. And it made the politics clear. So now I think pretty much everyone in this country knows that Kevin Rudd is failing on climate change. It was very important, and we did it well, partly because of the very brave and courageous efforts of three individuals. I was sitting in the National Press Club when these women got up and told Kevin Rudd that it is not good enough. And I was nearly up with them. But it's that kind of courage and determination that we saw from them that we're going to need from thousands of people all over the country this year, and that is what's going to drive this issue and create change. So where do we go from here? Four things. Polarise, organise, escalate, focus. So we need to polarise the debate. It's really hard to communicate about issues when they're grey, when you're not quite sure who stands where. We live in a world that's very noisy in the media debate. If something's not clear, people don't even hear about it, or if they do, they don't understand it, they don't know what the issue is. So for too long, the demands of the climate change movement have just been vague fluff, designed by policy wonks rather than communicators. A couple of examples. 80% cuts by 2050 based on 1990 levels. I mean, that is ridiculous. It tells the story that climate change is something that needs action in the future, and it tells the story that some greenhouse emissions are still okay because we don't have to cut all of them. Actually, climate change is an emergency. It's a life and death issue. We need action now, not in 2020, not in 2050. We need to shut down the entire coal industry as soon as humanly possible and replace it with 100% renewable energy. Now, the Green Paper on emissions trading had major flaws and needed substantial improvement in several key areas. We needed to reform this element and this element and this element. It told the story that essentially the Green Paper was heading in the right direction, it just needed a bit of tweaking. Actually, we've got a white paper. It doesn't need tweaking, it should be scrapped. It's dangerous legislation that should be opposed completely. It will enshrine the right to pollute and make emissions cuts much more difficult in future. It is so fundamentally flawed that it cannot be reformed. I'm going to elaborate on this a little bit because I think it's actually one of the most important strategic questions for the movement over the next few months. If this emissions trading scheme becomes law, it'll do nothing to cut greenhouse emissions. Like a 5% reduction, the recession will result in more than 5% cuts in greenhouse emissions. But what the ETS will do is enshrine the right to pollute as a property right. Now, no other emissions trading scheme in the world does that. The big polluters here have won a victory that the big polluters in other countries have not managed to win. And what that does is it means that in future, in 5 years' time, if we want to cut emissions more than 5%, we're going to have to compensate all of these big polluters who have their right to pollute locked in. Now, in my book, historically high pollution should incur responsibility, not rights. These companies should be fined, not rewarded. I mean, that's one issue. There's so many other issues. There's unlimited banking of permits. There's the ability to get as many offsets as you want from overseas. There's this additionality issue that Richard Dennis from the Australia Institute keeps on talking about where, you know, you'll put a cap on emissions reduction. So if you put a solar panel on your roof, it basically just allows Alcoa to pollute more. It is such a dangerous scheme, and the movement needs to be unequivocal on it. We need to be clear, we need to be united, so that when that legislation goes into the lower house to be passed, there are protests all over the country saying, no, this is not good enough. Go back to the drawing board. We need emissions cuts, not rights to pollute. Okay, so... I'm running out of time. I'll try and hurry up. Okay, we need to organise. We need a lot more power than we've got. We don't need 50% of people for a revolution, not at all. We need the majority of people supporting what we're doing, and we have that already. What we need is a small number of people who are very well organised, who are focused, and who are building power, building that political pressure where we can achieve change. So we need to be getting out, we need to be working with unions, we need to be working with faith-based groups, we need to be doing that networking and building a much bigger constituency of activists, not just people who understand the issue. Like, we've got broad understanding. I agree with what was being said before, we need a much better understanding of the urgency of the issue, but we need to be activating people. And we need to be building our organising capacity so that we can focus that pressure. I mean, it's one thing to go and meet with someone and tell them about climate change. It's another thing entirely to go and meet with them and leave that meeting with them having committed to do something to join the campaign. It's one thing to organise a public meeting with your MP. It's another thing to have your MP up there in front of their constituents being nailed to the floor for their failure to act on climate change. We need to escalate. We've got to stop being so damn polite. The Earth is dying. We're facing a climate emergency that threatens much of the life on this planet. When the laws of society are killing us, we have a moral obligation to take action and do what is right, regardless of those laws. It's self-defense. What are we going to say to our kids and the next generation? We tried, we asked politicians, and they didn't listen. I mean, that is not good enough. It is simply not acceptable. We need to make them listen, and when they don't, we need to take action ourselves. Al Gore and James Hansen have been calling for people to start taking civil disobedience to stop the construction of new coal plants. I think we need to be starting to do widespread civil disobedience to start closing the dirtiest coal plants. We need to start doing it this year. Last year, over 160 people were arrested around the country in some kind of direct action protest, somewhere or other. A lot of them had never done that before, and a lot of them, I think, had a very exciting and inspiring experience doing that, particularly if climate camp was something to go by. There's a lot of people out there who I think are ready to take serious action. And for those of you that have studied the history of social change, you'll know that civil disobedience is a very powerful mode of protest. We've seen that in the civil rights movement, with the Montgomery bus boycotts. We've seen that in the women's movement, the suffragist movement, with the Gandhian Indian Liberation Movement, the salt marches. We've seen that in the union movement, with mass strikes. And if we're going to get where we need to on climate change, we're going to need that kind of widespread civil disobedience, which is a fundamental refusal to play by the rules that are killing us if we're going to achieve change. So what I want to see in 2009 is the police literally having to arrest thousands of peaceful protesters in order for them to continue polluting. I want to see them having to arrest climate scientists. I want to see them to arrest Clive Hamilton, me, Kylie Minogue, my mum, Margaret Fulton, John Butler, Tim Flannery, Missy Higgins, all of us together. And I want to see MPs having to call the police to get rowdy constituents of mums and kids out of their office because they're not leaving, because they're having a picnic there until their MP gets off his arse, commits to a ban on new coal power stations and commits to phasing out coal. I want to see the AGMs of coal companies so heavily guarded by police because they're worried about protests that they are revealed to be the antisocial criminals that they are. And I want us to do it all in a peaceful, dignified manner that our kids will be proud of. Direct action for all, not just the radicals. Okay, so quickly, I'm probably going to get very rapid in a sec, so focus. We need to be doing widespread organising to build a mass movement that will fundamentally challenge the power relationships in our society. Absolutely, we need to do that. We also need clear political focus over the next 12 months. Who's got the power to give us what we want, and what do they care about? Our politicians, they care about getting elected. Fundamentally, they care about getting re-elected. Now, we need to delay the emissions trading scheme out of 2009. I think Malcolm Turnbull will probably help us on that front. We need to make sure that that decision remains... Well, we need to make sure that Kevin Rudd goes into 2010, an election year, with his key election promise on climate change unresolved. There are two cabinet ministers who live in Green Labor marginal seats. Albanese is the Minister for Infrastructure and Lindsay Tanner the Finance Minister. They need to lose their seat to the Greens in the next election. Yeah. And so does Martin Ferguson. At the moment, the ALP have been incredibly tight. There's been no dissenting voices within the ALP. That needs to change this year. There are progressive people in the ALP who, you go and meet with them, and they care about climate change. I mean, Kelvin Thompson has been quoting Climate Code Red in Hansard in the Senate, in Parliament. I mean, what's he doing? What's he said publicly? It's not good enough, Kelvin. People here who live in Kelvin's electorate or near Kelvin's electorate need to go and hammer him, letterbox, leaflet, public meetings, nail him to the floor until he starts coming out publicly. We need to split this congealed, massive, unaccountable power that is the federal ALP and start getting some of those people who claim to care about our future to come out and stand with us publicly rather than standing with the fossil fuel interests. Okay, and I'm going to wrap up now. So quickly, what do we need? We need common language. It's a climate emergency. We should call it that. If we don't call it that, we can't expect an emergency response. We need a unified demand. We need to scrap the CPRS and go back to the drawing board. 100% renewables in a decade and a target of 300 parts per million for the international agreement. And we need a couple of key moments to organise around. What I'd like to see is the kind of thing we saw after the White Paper, where we've got protests at MPs' offices all over the country happening every couple of months. I'd like us to organise, during the Arctic melt period in September, a mass blockade where we get thousands of people picking a power station that we're going to go to and actually go and turn it off with 5,000 to 10,000 people. And look, there's heaps of other stuff. But I just want to finish because I'll get flued off. The big polluters have got deep pockets. They've got a lot of money. They've got access to politicians that we don't have. They've got all of that. They've got PR firms. But we have something that they will never have. We have thousands of people, all of you, tens of thousands of people, who will go out, spend their weekends working and organising for no pay, because we have a deep and unending love of life and a belief in the future that they will never have. And in the end, hope will always triumph over fear.